thoughts and words are merely one way of getting across your attitude to another person. There are other ways. One way is through what you are. Sometimes a person can do it with music or somebody else with a painting. And I never disparage the ability of one person of high character to influence another profoundly, almost without a sound.
Without doing anything.
That's right. And that is one of the most difficult problems to handle in a society, because we do have people with that ability to just impress others.
Yes.
Where words would never move them. And we can't too lightly throw that aside.
We certainly can't.
And say, well, now we must build up this thing of the mind. As I thought about it last night, it seemed that what we need as a modern Quaker is sort of a composite of half a dozen different people. And maybe we can get that. I mean, maybe that's what Quakerism at its best really is. It's a composite. I think you certainly probably have seen that in committee meetings and conferences. It's the composite effect sometimes is most effective.
Of course, that's where the reason committees are. Committee decisions are often more safe than individual decisions, is because the composite nature of the thinking and the feeling of the group, if it can be merged satisfactorily, produces a stronger product than individual thinking.
I used to work with a bunch of fellows on engineering problems, and I'd always quote Confucius, who said, "What a fortunate man I am. Whenever I make a mistake, somebody finds it out."
Yes, that's right.
And that's your committee meeting at its best. I mean, it's a lot of friendly people with the same objective, and you feel, well, if I make a mistake, well, one of my friends will point it out.
Well, a great many years ago, a friend of mine who's not now living told me she didn't think I'd get on very well on committees.
Mm-hmm.
Because I probably wouldn't stand the foolishness that I'd hear. But, I said, does he have any advice about how to get on? I've been put on some of these committees. And she said, yes. Don't say anything for a year, but ask once in a while an intelligent question. That worked pretty well. She said, to the end of the year, they'll wonder what you're thinking.
Is that right?
But these people who get on and start right in and tell the committee what they know, they've got on now and they're going to tell you what to do.
Yeah.
Friends don't like it. I don't know whether other people do or not. But.
Well, you know, one thing you find in industry is that every profession has an occupational disease. The man who digs in the dusty atmosphere gets dust in his lungs. And I'm quite satisfied that the ministry, medicine, the legal profession, everyone has their own particular occupational disease. Unless you're careful, you slip over into a certain attitude of telling people or being super critical. I noticed among certain engineering consultants that they're super critical. I mean, everything they criticize.
Yes.
If they walk across the street, they'll criticize the curbstone, the pavement, the markings of the traffic light. I mean, everything in life has to be criticized. And those things can all be carried too far. And that is why, I think, we have to look back at the lives of the greatest people that have lived, because they seem to have developed tremendously in many directions and still avoided the weaknesses that most of us seem to pick up.
Yes, when you go into religion, and the Methodists are quite enthusiastic, but the Friends, on the other hand, are most too repressed in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
I was at Swarthmore yesterday, talking to some of the people out there. They went back over when Frank Adelot was made president. He suggested to the board that he should have a plan to go out and raise $1 million. And he thought that great enthusiasm if he had a plan for raising $1 million because he needed it, they'd be tremendously enthusiastic. And there was a silence for a while, they said in the board, the subordinate who told me this yesterday. And then somebody said, well, I think if Frank has that plan in mind, it would be no harm for him to try it.
Well,
and he didn't feel that friends were very enthusiastic about an enterprise. But the ones who get too enthusiastic jump into things without, that aren't well considered.
Well, there's a difference in personal characteristics we've observed, and I've wondered whether Quakerism is suited for all types of people. I don't think
it is. Oh, no, it isn't at all for all types of people. I think Quakerism as is, and even as it may become, was the only religion in the world where it would be fully off.
What do you think is the trend of Quakerism? I can see a few trends myself. I was wondering what you notice in the span of Quakerism as you have seen it.
Well, at present, I think Quakerism is looking up some. That I don't know how permanent and how deep-rooted the progress is. Because I think one reason it's looking up is that some of the foolish restraints of the past have been removed.
Mm-hmm.
That is, when friends thought they were really making a contribution of value by wearing queer clothes and using a queer language,
mm-hmm.
and why my sister used to say, I wonder that the friends used named the children. I think they'd have called them first, second, and third. And some of those things, being particular about saying thee and thou and way the dress and plain bonnets and collarless coats, all ridiculous things. But people, they were very sincere in having them. They thought they were expressing a testimony for simplicity. And the testimony for simplicity was never needed any more than it's needed today.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't express it that way. And I think the fact that we're learning not to try to express ourselves by being peculiar and cut off from other people,
mm-hmm.
and that we're not feeling that all other denominations are wrong, but are beginning to recognize that we're all trying for the same thing. But our vision is different and our ways are different. So toward getting there is helping Quakerism. I don't know. At least the little meeting is right up here that I go to every week, nearly every week. When we came up here 20 years ago, would have 15 or 20 people in attendance. Now last week we had 110. And this morning, not quite as many as that, because it's a pleasure, but still there were close to 100 people there. Abington meeting, when I first remember it, before your time, I expect,
I'm sure,
was dominated by a small conservative coterie who didn't want anything different.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted the meeting conducted in all its, lack of activities.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way it had been in their grandfather's time. And it didn't get on much. I went there a good many years ago. They gave me a subject to speak on. I think it was something about, I don't know, it was some observance of some day, and I said, now, of course you gave me this subject so that I couldn't say the thing I always say, that you're in a rut here and you need to move on and on and on.
Okay.
But that was, it was Columbus Day, I know,
mm-hmm.
because I hit on the poem Sail On, Sail mm-hmm. On.
Well, the speaker always gets his point over, I guess.
But Abington has undergone as great a transformation
mm-hmm.
as any meeting that I know. it has a very live group
mm-hmm.
of people who gather there. A certain degree of conservatism is useful.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps useful.
Well, what's the position, in your opinion, of discipline? Now, the folks that wore the plain clothes said, thee and thou, I agree with you, we're doing things that weren't important.
Yes.
But through those unimportant things, they disciplined themselves.
Yes.
They held themselves on a steady course. Now, what today is to be our substitute for that will hold us on a steady course?
Well, I think we see that everywhere. If you bring up children, aren't you? Well, of course, I don't know anything about bringing up children, that's the reason I talk about it. You will find that the kind of restraint, how old are your children?
Seven and nine.
Oh, well, your hard days are ahead. At that age, they think you know something.
They're beginning to change.
But they will doubt it after a little.
Mm-hmm.
They will think you're very nice people, but you don't know. They don't know. And the old people of the olden time held their children in line by a strict discipline, thou shalt do such things and thou shalt not do other things. And the children expected to accept it because other people's children did. But nobody's children do now.
Mm-hmm.
I read a very nice article on the discipline of parents, which is very useful. We are bound now, we know we are, to build up inner controls to take the place of the outer controls which are going to fail, which have largely failed. And the only way you're going to have your children brought up the way you'd be the kind of people you want is by helping them to develop inner controls so they can take care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That we've noticed in our youngsters. Sometimes we say they want to do something. We'll say, well, go ahead. This will probably happen. If you go out without a coat, you may catch cold. But you go ahead and make the decision yourself. And then they'll turn around and say, well, Daddy, you tell us what to do.
Yes, that's all right. When they decide that they want help,
yeah,
then you're in a position to get it to them.
Mm-hmm.
But take the members of the meeting as a whole. Our major problem today, I think we have to recognize, is overstimulation with trivial things in life.
Yes.
And we can't get away from it too easily. There's the newspaper, there's the advertising, there's the radio, there's the television, and so help me, there are your friends who insist upon talking of things that you're not too awfully interested in.
Yeah.
I used to rush home evenings to read the Reader's Digest, because if I didn't, somebody would tell me all about it the next couple of days, and I'd much rather read it myself.
Yeah.
Now, how do we get away from this overstimulation, and how do we somehow hold ourselves on a course like Whittier and some of these other fellows seem to do so well?
Well, we live in a much more difficult world than Whittier lived in.
Mm-hmm.
In exceedingly different and difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I've lived long enough, I'm about 90, to remember the Whittier age. This age too, and all the ages have gone in between. Well, we will have to, I think, be content to read more selectively, to listen to our radios more selectively, and not to be so much filled up with the idea that we have to be up on this so we can talk about it for other people meet. That's I don't think the men suffer as much from that as the ladies do. The women's clubs now and the women's luncheons, they have plenty of them. The women really have to read everything that's going, because they're going to talk about them. Other people know about them, and I don't. got to read that book,
mm-hmm.
talk about it. And most of the fiction that's written now isn't worth reading at all, and a great many other things aren't worth reading. I think we've got somewhat rigidly to limit, not by enactment, but for ourselves, to limit the areas in which we read and the things to which we listen. Of course, we mustn't turn the radio off every time anybody says anything we don't like.
That wouldn't be good either, I guess.
That wouldn't be good either.
I have felt that the one thing that may be absolutely necessary is a period of meditation every day. I mean, that may be absolutely necessary. And then other times during the course of the year, when you have a sustained period of maybe a couple of days in a silent retreat or something like that,